From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has decided that the thousands of people disobeying stay-at-home orders around the country in the midst of a dangerous pandemic are, quote, great people. From Annapolis, Maryland to San Diego, California, pro-Trump protesters are demanding give me liberty or give me death, labeling quarantine orders as tyranny. Meanwhile, there's little critique from them about the failure of the government to help ordinary Americans, as millions lose employment and healthcare, cannot pay rent or mortgage, and suffer from food insecurity. My guest is David Dayan. He is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, HuffPost, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and more. His first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, was the winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize and was released in 2016. Since the pandemic was declared, he's been sending out a newsletter of the most critical COVID-19 related news called Unsanitized. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you for having me.
So these protests that have broken out in cities around the country, I suppose it feels like it's a very American thing. It's also a sort of sign of the times in terms of the fake news and its influence on Americans who support Trump. But it seems pretty nakedly clear that Trump is egging these folks on because he wants to be able to say that it's not his fault that the economy is failing. And if they can actually succeed in overturning quarantine, maybe the economy would improve and thereby improve his own chances of re-election. Is that basically it?
Well, I think Trump's playing a pretty dangerous game. I mean, I think he is trying to recapture sort of the magic of the Tea Party that happened after the last financial crisis and bailout package. And that did succeed in 2010 in those elections in moving Republicans toward victory. However, I think that much like the Tea Party, these are sort of fake grassroots organizations. It seems like there are a lot of ties to gun groups and ties to political organizations. The problem is that if there is success, first of all, these are pretty small gatherings relative to the public at large that seems to be very much on board with social distancing measures and keeping the country locked down until it is safe to go out in public in these ways. If these small groups of protesters, which are being really hyped up by the media, are successful, in some way in accelerating the reopening of the country, as it were, and we're not prepared as a country to reopen. In other words, we don't have the testing in place. We don't have the ability to know if somebody is out there in the nation who is contagious and potentially infecting others. Then we're just not going to get, we're just going to get another surge, right? We're just going to have this sort of endless wave of opening and closing the country, opening and closing the country. And that will be worse economically than the situation that we're in right now. And that will almost ensure Trump's defeat if there's a premature opening and then a rapid return to closure. So I think what he's doing is incredibly dangerous. It's certainly sort of a form of civil unrest, and it doesn't seem like it will be guaranteed to secure the goals that he appears to have.
He also seems to be using the protesters as a weapon against governors, right? This is a battle between the federal government and state governors, with state governors rightly accusing the federal government of failing to provide them with the equipment that they need, sabotaging their orders, even stepping in and swooping the equipment they've procured. And if Trump can say it's a governor's fault that the economy has failed, then again, he is, he sort of succeeds in trying to let himself off the hook in his own plane of reality. Whether that'll actually be believed by the rest of the country is not known. But this seems to be a bludgeon against the governors, right? Is he called to liberate Minnesota and other states?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, all the states that he mentioned that needed to be liberated happen to have Democratic governors.
Right.
And he is certainly wanting to shift blame wherever possible, whether it's to China or the WHO or state governors, just anything to keep the focus off of his personal failings in responding to the pandemic. So that's certainly true, and particularly in the case of Michigan, where Gretchen Whitmer, the first term governor there, is seen as a potential vice presidential pick. This has even more resonance of attacking her, trying to pit the citizens of Michigan against the governor is a way to do an early boost to attacking the Democratic ticket or potential Democratic ticket in November. Now, a poll recently out of Michigan shows that Whitmer has widespread support for her actions during this crisis, about 20 points positive, whereas Trump is about 10 or 15 points negative in the state of Michigan. So,
right.
Whether this will work or not remains to be seen.
Right. Polling shows that the governors of major states battling the coronavirus are actually quite popular. Andrew Cuomo in New York, regardless of how New Yorkers actually feel about him nationwide, he's quite popular. Even Gavin Newsom in California is being hailed for taking strict action early on. So what the federal government could be doing and what Congress could be doing so much better is simply financially supporting Americans. This does not seem to be an angle that the protesters are critiquing, right? We're not seeing them angry about the fact that corporations seem to be once more getting bailed out and America at a taxpayer expense and Americans left high and dry with just minimal, breadcrumbs being thrown to them from Congress. So we are at a stage now where Congress is looking at a second bill, actually it would be the third or fourth bill related to the coronavirus, but an extension to the small business loan. Is Congress doing enough, just even setting aside the payments to Americans, is it doing enough for small businesses in America?
Well, no, not so far. I mean, the small business lending program known as the Paycheck Protection Program or PPP, which was a $350 billion program, ran out in less than 2 weeks. And I believe something like 1.5, 1.6 million small businesses were able to secure loans. Now, whether they're actually all small, I'll get to in a minute, but there are 30 million businesses in America with less than 500 employees, which is the definition of a small business under this bill. And so you're really talking about 1/20 or so of the demand in terms of the total small business in America, most of which are shut down. You're talking about restaurants and shopping locations, retail outlets, things like that. You're talking about very little of these individuals who are actually getting help. Interestingly, because of a provision put in the bill saying that as long as you have less than 500 employees at any one location, a chain of, for example, restaurants or hotels could be eligible for this small business money. We know that Ruth's Chris Steakhouse received two helpings of the maximum amount of $10 million in loan support through this program.
And they how Ruth's Chris even qualifies as a small business, I have no idea. I mean, they have like hundreds of restaurants around the country. And this is supposed to be for businesses that have fewer than 500 employees.
Right. So the provision was that as long as the business has less than 500 employees at any single location, they will be in line. So Ruth's Chris, Potbelly, which is a chain of sandwich shops, that started in Washington. I think they're in the Northeast. Shake Shack originally got a $10 million loan through this program and then revealed that they got support through a regular business loan of tens of millions of dollars. And once that came out, they gave back the $10 million loan from the government. But the point is that larger companies appear to be favored here. I mean, it cost the small business program was run through banks, and it cost them about the same amount of money to process a $50,000 loan as it does to process a $1 million loan. And so who do you think that they are going to support? Larger so-called small businesses rather than mom and pop stores that really need this money as a lifeline to survive. So I don't believe that this program was administered very well, and it clearly ran out in such a way that it was woefully inadequate. As you mentioned, Congress is trying to re-up some more money into that, but I don't know that that's going to be enough either. And it seems like the way that it's going about this business is not conducive to keeping millions of small businesses alive. The greater likelihood is that you're going to see a massive loss of restaurants and local mom and pop stores all across the country, and that's really sad.
Right. So this is a situation where, as you said, the controls are not very good on who's getting the money. And if Congress simply extends the amount available in the loans without actually strengthening the controls, or at least favoring the smaller businesses, then we're going to have more of the same. And this is all, you know, once if the terms of the loan are met, as in they don't furlough or lay off employees, the loans turn into forgivable. They turn forgivable. They turn into grants, which is taxpayer money, right?
Right. So, you know, a Ruth's Chris would be eligible for, you know, $20 million in grants. They had one separate subsidiary of the company get a $10 million, which was the maximum amount that the Small Business Administration said you could get through this program. So they actually doubled their pleasure by using separate subsidiaries of the same company, which seems a violation of the spirit of the law and enough for SBA to kick them out of the program. But, you know, we'll see what they do. It does seem to me that there's a definite lack of control. And then you compare that to what Congress and the Federal Reserve are doing for large corporations, which is a $500 billion program that gets fed, that's taxpayer money, gets fed into the Federal Reserve, which levers it up, could be as high as $4.5 trillion of support, which is really almost unlimited support for giant corporations. If you believe, as I do, that the small business sector is going to consolidate pretty massively because of loss of businesses, stores closing, things like that, and you see this amazing amount of support for large corporations, you're just going to see a concentration of more wealth and power in fewer and fewer hands. And that's what this bill, the CARES Act, that was passed in March, really facilitates.
So essentially, are you saying big corporations will have the capability, financial capability of sweeping up and buying up smaller and smaller small businesses, and thereby you have fewer and fewer entities controlling these smaller businesses if they don't go out of business altogether?
Yes, absolutely that. And also the fact that if you know, you're in retail, and Amazon or Costco or Walmart is doing pretty well, and all of your competitors at the local level are going out of business, then just by default, you're going to consolidate the sector because there are just going to be fewer places for people to shop. So a combination of those two factors is going to increase wealth and power within the corporate sector.
Let's talk about the $1,200 checks that Americans were supposed to receive, individuals, this is. It was supposed to be up to $1,200. If you made more money, you would get a smaller check. It's not clear if everyone has received their checks. We know that they were delayed by a few days because Trump insisted on having a signature. And now we're hearing that debt collectors are angling to snatch those checks up before people can get their hands on them and use them to pay for necessities. What do you know about this aspect of it?
So I did a significant amount of reporting on this. I was able to obtain a call from the Treasury Department to bank compliance officers that explained all this and essentially gave banks the green light to take these stimulus checks. The core issue here is that if you get a federal benefit like Social Security or veterans benefits, disability benefits, those are protected from private debt collection. And that's for a good reason, right? Those are payments that people need to survive. That's what they live on in many cases. And so we, government has decided they don't want to take those payments away to fulfill an existing debt. So they protect those payments. They're flagged and banks know that they can't take them. These stimulus checks were not flagged in the same way. They are considered tax credits. And so when they go into somebody's bank account, they are not coded in such a way that they are protected from private debt collectors who have an order against an individual to take any money that they can find to offset a debt, or they're not protected from the banks themselves. If you have a negative balance in your account, the bank at their discretion, once that stimulus money comes in through direct deposit, can take that money. And we found many instances of various banks actually doing this. U.S. Bank, a bank called Radius Bank in Massachusetts, that since reversed its practice after we reported on them. And then USAA, which serves military families. I talked to a family who had $3,400 for a wife, a husband, and two kids taken from them from an account in USAA that they thought they had closed. There was a dispute over the account, over a certain debt. USAA said they owed it. The family said it was fraud. They abandoned the account. It was charged off, which means the bank believes that they're never going to collect on it. But it was still in the IRS's system under direct deposit as where checks for, you know, refunds for this individual family would go. And so the IRS sent the money to USAA, to this seemingly defunct account, and USA used it to offset that existing debt. So when I questioned USA about this, they admitted that that was their policy. And there was a lot of public outrage when I reported the story last week. And USA changed its policy and refunded this family and all other families who they took this money from. But, you know, there are 4,500 banks in the United States, and I'm not going to be able to get to every single one of them. And so the real solution here is for the Treasury Department to write a regulation that protects these payments. And they're allowed to do that under the CARES Act legislation. Hmm. They have chosen not to do that so far. And wow. Now we're hearing these stories of dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of individuals who are getting their stimulus checks, which is supposed to be used for food and medicine and necessities and emergency payment, being garnished either by private debt collectors or by their own bank.
And you don't see the right-wing protesters saying much about that when they are descending upon cities. You are also someone who's covered the issue of housing for many years, and this is a huge issue now as millions of Americans have lost their jobs. How they will pay their rent or mortgage payments is really in question, and certain states have passed orders with eviction moratoriums or rent deferments. But many point out that often, even if rent or mortgage payments are put off by 3 months or however long the crisis continues, at the end of that, the homeowner or the renter would then owe the lump sum money that they weren't able to earn and don't have in the bank. Ilhan Omar, representative of Minnesota, has proposed a new bill. She put it out on Friday, a very interesting bill that would protect renters and mortgage payers. What do you make of her bill? What do you make of the current state of housing in the coronavirus crisis?
I think Representative Omar is absolutely right. You need to stop these payments, and you can't make it a balloon payment on the back end. If you can't afford $2,000 a month right now, what makes anyone think that you're going to be able to afford $6,000 in 3 months? It just doesn't make any sense. If that's the way that this goes, then you're just delaying this reckoning of a huge foreclosure and eviction crisis. I'm hearing a lot about how eviction moratorium aren't even working, that in various cities that are supposed to have these protections, landlords are still moving to evict. In many cases, this is at the responsibility of the borrower to go to their mortgage company and tell them, I want to be eligible for this, deferment of payment. The servicer won't just apply it. They have to ask for it. The same thing with rent and any kind of deferment on that. So it's the burden is all on the individual here. And I think that we're going to have a heck of a crisis on our hands if things continue in that form. These individuals who are, lost their job through no fault of their own during a global pandemic, they're going to need a lot more help. It was the first of the month in April, and this $1,200 payment might offset some people's rent problems, but it didn't show up until last week. It's the first of the month is coming again, May 1st. And if you manage to scrape up enough money to pay your rent in April, I don't know what's left for you to pay your rent in May. For a lot of people, I saw one report that one third of all renters didn't pay their rent in May in certain parts of the country. So or in April, and May is probably going to be worse. So I think it's something that policymakers need to think about really deeply, because, there's an old saying, like, if you owe the bank $100, that's your problem. But if you owe the bank $1 billion, that's their problem. And it's sort of like that. If there's one tenant that needs to be evicted, that's the tenant's problem. But if there are millions and millions of tenants that would cause a mass vacancy crisis that need to be evicted, that's the landlord's problem. And the landlord and the tenants are going to have to come together and come up with a solution.
Many people are calling for a rent strike on May 1st. There are also calls for a general strike. Finally, David, do you feel that now is a good time for a universal basic income? There, I know, has been at least one bill proposed for Americans to receive a $2,000 monthly payment from the government.
Well, I mean, the stimulus checks are kind of a very small and one-time form of that. The boost in unemployment paychecks, which adds an extra $600 a week to those who get unemployment claims, is another form of that. That's hindered by the fact that state unemployment systems are absolutely buckled right now. It can take you weeks and weeks to get through. But that's another way in which universal basic income is almost being tested out in this crisis. One thing I think is problematic with these is that they're all short-term programs. And if they go away, for example, if you are unemployed and you are getting this extra $600 a week and it was really helping, and that goes away, and all of a sudden there's 20, 25, 20, 30% unemployment, and you have no job and you're not connected to your employer, what are you going to do? I think Bernie Sanders' bill that Pramila Jayapal has a version of in the House called the Paycheck Security Act, which simply says, all right, everybody who's on payrolls now, the payroll processing companies can just bill the government and the government can pay that, is probably a better solution. It keeps people connected to their companies. It gives them their full salary. It keeps their health insurance, which is another huge problem in this crisis, because we stupidly have health insurance tied to our employment. Millions of people are losing their health insurance right now. So, a lot of that universal basic income is going towards trying to pay for health insurance. And so I think this payroll support idea, which is more universal, is probably a better way of handling the near-term crisis. In the long term, we're going to have these discussions about whether a universal basic income makes sense.
David, I want to thank you so much for joining us. How can people get a hold of your or subscribe to your unsanitized newsletter?
Sure. You can go to prospect.org. That's at the American Prospect, and you can sign up there. I can tell you that all of our unsanitized newsletters are available online as well, and we have a section of the website for those. It's the Unsanitized Daily section, and you can see that on the homepage there at prospect.org. All of our coronavirus coverage is at prospect.org/coronavirus. So if you want to come to the website or if you want to get it in your email, all of the information is available there for you to figure that out.
It's been very useful for me to see your rundown on a regular basis in my inbox. Highly recommend it. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, Sonali, thank you.
My guest has been David Day, and the executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, HuffPost, The Washington Post, The LA Times, and more. His first book was entitled Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And he's been sending out a regular newsletter around the COVID-19 crisis called Unsanitized. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.